This is CS50 Friday of week zero. Welcome back for those returning. Welcome to CS50 for those joining us for the first time. Typically, we will not, in fact, have classes on Fridays, just this week and next for shopping week and Labor Day. But thereafter, we will indeed be Monday, Wednesday. So one of the side effects, perhaps, of a course like this is that it begins to open your eyes to all sorts of technical curiosities in society and technical inaccuracies in society. And so what I did this morning, this is literally how I spent my morning, was troll around YouTube looking for nice incarnations of things that perhaps yesterday you might not have blinked at, but 10 weeks from now you should absolutely poke fun at these people. So with that said, I give you a little something from YouTube.
For weeks I've been investigating the Cabbie Killer murders with a certain morbid fascination.
This is in real time. I'll create a GUI interface using Visual Basic. See if I can track an IP address.
So, there we have. I'll create a GUI interface using Visual Basic. See if I can track an IP address. So, a lot of technical words independently that are very much accurate and used in technical context. But GUI, graphical user interface, kind of one said a graphical user interface interface. Two, using Visual Basic. So this is kind of a modern show, and that is kind of a retro language. And it's also, as will be one of the takeaways of this course, completely irrelevant to what problem you are solving. The fact that this engineer is proclaiming to use Visual Basic really is not a compelling part of the story. And finally, see if I can track an IP address. Well, all of that might in fact be the goal, but it's when you start hearing things like this, hopefully, that you'll at least start to grimace a little bit. Let me pull up a second one. Turns out it's also from CSI. Let me make sure that the user annotations are disabled this time. And let's take a little look at this one here.
This is the vacation shot that gives us something to work with. The tourist was taking a picture of this girl. So, enlarging the reflection in her eye. I'm going to slide the image over. There's our victim. Upper right.
Okay. So, when you are working with source material that looks like this, there is, in fact, no such thing as infinite zoom in computer science. You cannot just tell the computer to enhance that, or can you clean that up, and then magically you zoom in not only on the image but also on the reflection of the victim in someone's eyeball. So here too are they taking some liberties. But thankfully I also found in my trolling around this morning something that is perhaps technically motivating and at least germane for those of you, which is many of you, who actually use Gmail. You might have seen a little advert in the top right hand corner recently saying new beta version of a little something called Gmail Priority Inbox. So this one's not a spoof. It's actually a pretty cute video, and it offers us the opportunity to just take a look at some of the kinds of ideas we'll be looking at in this course. So I give you your Gmail priority inbox. If you haven't turned it on or don't know what that thing is, here you go.
Thank you.
So if you've ever wondered, that is in fact how Gmail works underneath the hood. So what are the takeaways, though, for us? So there's actually some really interesting computer science ideas underlying that. We promised on Wednesday that computer science, and this course in particular, isn't at the end of the day about programming, even though that is, in fact, how you will spend a good amount of your time and the skill that you will, in fact, walk away with. But it's about approaching something that you actually care about. For instance, just even something workaday, like managing your email and getting through the day more efficiently and trying to answer a lot more cleverly, a lot more effectively, questions like, which things do I care about? I mean, these are the kinds of things that computers can, in fact, if programmed effectively, help us with. So this little video suggested there's a couple of heuristics that a computer or that a programmer could use to figure out what emails are important to someone like me. We looked at what emails you reply to. If you reply, in theory, that suggests this user must care about whoever sent this email or the topic they're in. If you actually read it, that's a useful indicator. Are there other indicators or tricks or rules of thumb that just off the top of your head come to you as useful mechanisms for doing this as well? Yeah. So that's a good one. So whether or not the email is addressed specifically to you in like the to field, or if maybe you were BCC'd, or it's a big email list of which you're just part, that could signify that this is in fact useful for you. Yep, and back. So what the subject is, okay, so if it's something like, you know, buy such and such, a whole bunch of spam, I mean, buy could actually be a negative indicator that this is probably not of interest to the user, whereas please help, or dinner, or something like that might actually be more compelling to a human. Other thoughts that come to mind? Yeah, in the middle. OK, good. So in Gmail context, most of you know you can delete things, but most people just save or archive emails. So if you archive it, that's maybe a little hint that either this is just your habit, or perhaps that you might actually care about this later in the future. Whereas if you delete it, you really don't care. Yeah. So who the sender is. So maybe you could keep track of just who your most frequent correspondents are. And if you keep seeing the same person from person X or person Y coming into your inbox, and clearly I like having a dialogue with these people or have to for work, that might in fact bubble up in your inbox. Other thoughts? Speed of response, right? So I actually do tend to respond to some people's emails more quickly than others. And that, in fact, might be a useful indicator. And if I'm already in this habit, let my software, let my computer do that thinking for me and bubble up to the top of my attention what I should address first. And another idea? So how long you leave the window open. So this one, too, is an interesting heuristic. And these kinds of ideas are actually really prevalent in like the advertising world. And I'm sure sites like Facebook and the like actually do keep track of how much time you spend using this application or how much time you spend on this particular page so that they can infer from that behavior what you actually care about and what you might actually look at more intensely. So feel free to play with this if you like. I just turned it on literally this morning to start playing. And I'm on myself a couple of email lists, one of which had an email this morning saying, hey, has anyone tried this? It really kind of sucks. Whereas the other email list said completely the opposite. So it's this interesting scenario where it's probably hit or miss, certainly early on. And as one of the clips there indicated, these are the kinds of things where computers ideally have to learn over time. A priori, Google is probably not going to know what you care about, but if it watches you over some amount of time, just like it's been for years with advertisements, can this kind of algorithm, this kind of process, presumably improve? So that's perhaps a hint of where we're going in the future. So for those of you joining us for the last time, know that the video of Wednesday, as will generally be the case, is already online. You can go to cs50.net/lectures, and that will lead you to a link where the video is nicely embedded in HDV, thanks to our videographers this year. What you'll see here is a little clip of what I showed on Wednesday, whereby this semester, for the first time, we'll be including, after a few days, takes a few days of human labor, we will be transcribing the lectures in their entirety. Word for word, awkward as it is for me to actually see the words I'm saying in retrospect, but you will then be able to read what's there, do keyword search based on anything that I happen to say, if you search for this in a few days' time, and similarly, can you click on any sentence in the transcript, jump right to that point in the video, so this is very much online education CS50 style, and if you speak other languages that I don't, you can nonetheless compel me to speak speak them, at least in subtitle form. So I wanted to take a few excerpts from the course's syllabus, since it's not an interesting document to walk through line by line, but something you should read at some point very soon. What ultimately matters in this course is not so much where you end up relative to your classmates, but where you end up in week 12 relative to yourself in week 0. And so this really is the mantra of the course. One of the concerns out of the gate for students in this course, particularly those we dubbed less comfortable, is that you're already starting off at a disadvantage. My God, this student sitting next to me was programming since he or she was 6. This person next to me took AP computer science. And that may actually be the case. And statistically, it probably is the case to some extent. But it really doesn't matter. I mean, unlike a lot of the courses here and at universities, we really do take a much more individualistic approach. And that is to say, at the end of the day, do we consider both upward trending, both your initial experience, and also how you approach the course's projects throughout the course of the semester. You can nonetheless take the course pass-fail. I mentioned this on Wednesday, and this is actually something very near and dear to my heart, because I literally would not be doing what I do in life today had I not taken a couple of courses here, this one in particular, pass-fail. It helped me in my mind sort of take that step that I was otherwise just a little too hesitant to take my freshman year. And then for a lot of students too, what this mechanism does is it just takes the edge off a course like this. Odds are, if you're an upperclassman, you've had that experience where it's 12 a.m., 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and you're really starting to stress over the incompletion of some problem set for some course. Well, frankly, what this mechanism allows you to do, if you're already 90% of the way there, you can call it a night, and you can put it down, and you can feel good nonetheless about where you got to. And that, in my mind, is one of the upsides of taking a course like this, pass-fail, in order to take the edge off. The course is not, FYI, graded on a curve. There is no predetermined cutoffs between letter grades for those who do take letter grades, and those less comfortable and somewhere in between are not at a disadvantage, as the syllabus promises, vis-a-vis those more comfortable. I do have conversations with all 30-plus of the teaching fellows about all 300-plus of the students at the end of the semester, and that is, in the end, what determines the outcome. So some of the mechanisms that are in place now to make the next several weeks among the most memorable of experiences. So with the problem sets is where you really will get your hands dirty and truly immerse yourself in this world of computer science and programming. But life happens. Stuff comes up with sports, with student groups, with illness and the like. So the course very generously offers 9 late days that you can spend at your discretion throughout the semester. You can take 1 late day on one P set, 9 late days on one P set. It really is up to you to manage throughout the term. We also drop the lowest score on a problem set. And also, lest my appeal in last lecture and this sound a little too tailored to only those less comfortable, realize too, those more comfortable, as we'll see today, for those do we offer what we call hacker editions of each of the problem sets. We do expect a majority of the students to tackle, as you'll see tonight when the PDFs go online at 7 p.m., the so-called standard edition of each problem set. But if you are so inclined, whether for this problem set or any other throughout the term, you can change your mind week to week. Do you have available to you what we call the hacker editions, and more details on those in the courses syllabus. And besides that, lest that not be enough to make sure everyone can succeed in a course like this, we have a very diligent teaching fellow who not only likes to scribe the course's lectures. It's not much fun to read 20 pages of my verbal text written, but having a few pages of authoritative notes do exist. A teaching fellow for each lecture takes what we call scribe notes. These are posted within a few days online. He likes to include some snarky comments in the footnotes, generally about me at my expense, so keep an eye out for those. And the point of this is so that you don't come to class heads down the whole time thinking everything I say is absolutely worthy of being written down. Ideally, like we started today, it'll be a bit more like a conversation to the extent that's possible in a theater like this. 150-plus office hours is the current tally that you'll see starting to appear on the course's website thanks to our 60-plus person staff. And you'll also see online soon, once you have your accounts as per problem set 0 spec, for the course's website, there'll be support forms and an email address, help@cs50.net, that you can turn to. And frankly, this is more a commentary on our lack of social lives during the term, but we pride ourselves generally on 5 or so minute response times at most hours during the day. So it's a sick obsession with some of us, myself included. So with that said, what can you do? So this is such a silly thing, but 15 years ago, I took this course followed by a course called CS51 and then sat down one night and ended up spending the next week on this project, even though I lived in Mather House, never really was the shuttling type. I had a lot of quad friends who did, and this was kind of interesting to me. There was this big printout of the shuttle schedule, and this was not a very navigable document. Certainly, this is like mid-1990s. We did have the web and the internet, but things were slow, and it just wasn't really conducive to actually finding things quickly unless you really gave some thought to the problem. So I sat down over the course of a week and implement what I probably shouldn't have called Shuttle Boy at the time, because this jargon has lived on. And this is now a program that's web-based, it's SMS-based, it's voice-based, and it used to be Linux-based, as you'll see in a couple of weeks. And it's just a program that lets you click where you are, click where you want to go, and voila, here are the next several shuttles that you can take. I thought I'd give you a little glimpse at what you can do for your final project toward term's end. We own our own phone number. That allows you to input keystrokes like you would any system. And this is an example of what we call CS50 voice. And that's an example of someone else's phone.
This is CS50 for Shuttle Boy. Press 1 to start over. Press 0. What is your origin for quad? Press 1. Mather. Press 2. Boylston. Press 3. Lamont. Press 4. Meters Hall. Press 5. To start over. Press 0.
So I'll press 1 for quad.
The next shuttle leaves in 2 minutes at 1:30 p.m. and then at 1:40 p.m., 1:50 p.m., and 2 p.m. This is CS50.
So that is only... That is only option one. We have like 9 more slots to fill. So that's 9 potential final projects that can live on in telephone form towards semester's end. And we will show you exactly how you can write programs that actually interact with the user in that way. And just as a fun aside, we also realize, as computer scientists, that sometimes technology is not the answer. This is an unfortunate thing you see throughout education, frankly, certainly at the secondary and primary school level, where you just insert technology into the classroom and expect it to solve problems. That is not in life always the case. Sometimes the simplest solutions are, in fact, the best. And thus, consistent with this constant reminder to ourselves, was born last year what we dubbed Shuttle Boy Cards. Now, granted, we're now starting to take this whole shuttle theme to an extreme, perhaps. But we realized, you know what, it's actually not that efficient sometimes to call a phone number. It's not that efficient to pull up the mobile web. Sometimes it's a lot easier to reach into your wallet, pull out a piece of plastic, and voila, there are the next several shuttle times. We mention this only because we've just gone to press with the latest incarnation of this year. So if you go back to shuttleboy.cs50.net, you can pre-order for free your own CS50 shuttle card, particularly those of you in the quad, Mather, and the like. So what does that mean as you exit a course like this? Well, really, the things we've looked at thus far can you do after just a semester of this kind of material, an exposure to this particular world. I just wanted to draw your attention to some of the handouts we had Wednesday, which are still available today if you didn't yet get them. This is targeted, for the most part, at students who might want to major or minor in computer science, but there's also some interesting detail toward the end of this document, if and when you get a chance to peruse, including this chart that shows you the pathways that you can take throughout computer science here, sort of recommended or popular courses that students tend to take, even if they are in the humanities or life sciences or social sciences, but want to round out their education here with something in the computing sciences. Do we have quads of courses recommended in the back that you can take after 50 in order to get a minor in this stuff? And frankly, this kind of stuff, this visualization of data, this is one of the themes of a course here called CS171, Visualizations, which we'll actually hear a bit about toward the end of the semester. And it's all about taking data that might very well have come out of a computer and trying to decide what is, in fact, the best way to present this data. To be honest, especially those of you less comfortable here, if you've ever struggled with some program or struggled with some piece of software, odds are it's not your fault. It just really wasn't designed very well. So actually thinking about how humans interact with machines and how you can optimize your so-called user interface or GUI interface is also one of the themes in this particular field. So we ended Wednesday with some quotes, particularly from IsawYouHarvard.com. We thought it'd be fun to just give you a couple of teasers from another favorite website of ours, a little something called Harvard FML. Search for CS50, and you see some choice quotes like this. I talk about CS50 so much that my teammates implemented a CS50 talk tax. I get charged $1 for each mention of the class. I already owe $20 and haven't been able to talk for more than 5 minutes without getting called out on it. FML. This is what happens over time, as does, whoops, did I miss one there? This is what may in fact happen to you over time. We are a recurring theme, it seems, on that particular website. So now let's make things a little more technical for a moment. Those of you more comfortable, rest assured we'll start filling in some gaps before long if already familiar with this, but all of you in this room probably remember what we technically call the base 10 system or decimal system, because back in grade school or the like, you learned to count and add and subtract numbers by way of columns. The so-called ones column on the right, the tens column next to it, the hundreds column, the thousands column, and so forth. So if you had some number back in grade school, like 123, well, why do we express this as 123 when really I just see on the board 123? Well, we have what? One in the so-called hundreds columns, a two in the so-called tens column, so that's 10 times 1, plus 10 times 2 is 120, plus 3 times 1, 123. All right, so completely uninteresting if this is something long familiar to you, but it turns out computers work in exactly the same way. The so-called binary system, these zeros and ones that you probably have some vague sense underlie all computers today, actually reduced to the exact same grade school kind of math and system, except with computers, because it's a lot easier to use just two digits, 0 and 1, do they use only columns like the ones column, the twos column, the fours column, and the eights column? And if you noticed earlier that these are what we'd call powers of 10, these are just powers of 2. So if you need more bigger numbers, you just have a 16s column and a 32s column and so forth. So what's the takeaway here? Well, if we actually want to represent something like the number 7, well, in binary, not actually in decimal like this, well, what do? If we need 7, this is the ones column, the twos, fours, eights. So here are our columns, and this was our decimal system a moment ago, and I want to express the number 7, and the only digits I now have access to are 0 and 1, whereas in decimal, dec meaning 10, I had 0 to 9, which was 10, 0 and 1, bi meaning 2, I have binary numbers now. I can only put a 0 or 1 in each of these slots. But after that, the math is the same. 8 times whatever, 4 times whatever, 2 times whatever, and so forth. So what's 7? Right. 1, 1, 1, and then a 0. And just like in the decimal system, you can put as many leading zeros, as many zeros on the left that you want. They're completely inconsequential. And so we now have the number 7. Meanwhile, the number 0 is? All right, it's all zeros, so I'll just for consistency use 4 of them here, but that's just an aesthetic. And I mentioned on Wednesday that computer scientists do in fact start counting from 0, not 1. Well, this is pretty much why, because if your whole numbering system reduces to this basic idea of zeros and ones, each of which is in a certain column, each of which has some weight associated with it, it's just natural, it's obvious to start counting at 0, otherwise you're wasting a bit, so to speak, unnecessarily. And a bit, B-I-T, just a shorthand for binary digit. So a digit is 0 or 1. Bi means 2. You only have 2 digits. Hence, the word bit was born. So just as a little sanity check, number 15 in binary would be, yeah, just 4 ones. And how about the number 65,535? Anyone? You know you're a nerd if. So 16 of those ones will give you that particular number. And I can't myself go higher than that, but you could certainly do it mathematically. Now, this is not the kind of stuff that computer scientists spend all their time doing, but it will be germane. In fact, midway through the semester, when we look at the notion of digital forensics and recovering things like JPEGs and representing files like JPEGs and GIFs and the like on disk, we're actually going to have to revisit this idea of actually storing information in zero or one form. And so it's going to become relevant as to how you represent these numbers on disk, how you manipulate these numbers on disk, but this really only gives us the ability to express numbers at this point in time. We ultimately want to be able to express letters so we can implement things like Gmail and actually implement text on the screen. So how do we do that? Well, first, a cartoon that you might now actually get, those otherwise unfamiliar. See, this happens every semester. The chuckles, the grimaces kind of roll through the crowd as people catch on. But there you go. Now you get geek humor. And for better or for worse, we've done a lot of damage over the past few years with this stuff. Well, you get more and more acquainted with geek humor from the likes of This Is Foxtrot, XKCD is popular, PhD Comics. There's a whole bunch of geekery out there that we'll perhaps turn to so that you do exit this course as a complete side effect with an understanding as to why it was funny or at least awkward that we did, in fact, on Wednesday have a cat pictured in a ceiling. So, how do you go from just numbers, zeros and ones, to actually useful information? Well, it turns out a bunch of years ago, people just decided that if we have the ability to express numbers, and we actually care about expressing letters of the alphabet, well, we just need some kind of mapping between one and the other. And so thus was born what's generally called ASCII. This is just an acronym that you still see in use today, though there are newer systems that are more expressive for other languages, non-Romance languages. But ASCII is just a code. This might look a little cryptic at first, but it turns out there's some very obvious patterns here. For instance, according to this chart, if you want to represent the letter A in the so-called ASCII system, what number do you actually use to do so? So lowercase a would be 97, and uppercase A would be 65. So this is kind of a nice cheat sheet. Now, once you know each of those, you can now do 25 more uppercase letters and 25 more lowercase letters. Then there's some other stuff like punctuation and things you see on the keyboard. All of those do need their own encodings. But at the end of the day, if you already knew coming into this class that your computer stores information somehow using zeros and ones, well, it turns out that if you have typed the letter A on your keyboard and thus need to store that inside of your computer, well, how do you actually go from numbers to that letter and back? Well, again, we can go to our ones column, 2s, 4, 8, 16, 32. So we can go to 32, and then we can go to 64, and then 128, and this gives me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So this is intentional. I now have 8 columns, though sloppily written there, 8 columns or 8 bits. So this is what we know as a byte. You've probably been surrounded for years now by bytes and kilobytes and megabytes and terabytes and the like. Well, this is just a way of saying not bits, but units of 8 bits at a time. Why is this useful? Well, 1 bit, really not all that useful. 2 bits, still not all that useful. 8 bits, starting to get useful because, in fact, with 8 bits, can you implement things like this? So with 8 bits, can you express 256 possible characters? That's pretty good, because now I can pretty much cover my American keyboard pretty effectively, both uppercase, lowercase, and a whole bunch of punctuation. For other languages, as an aside, there are other encoding schemes when there are more characters. So what would be the letter A in binary inside of a computer's memory when you hit the letter A on the keyboard for capital A? Yeah, 0, 1. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. And so this, in fact, when you say your computer stores information as zeros and ones, you've just typed the capital letter A. That's all that's going on inside. Now, how is that actually being implemented? It actually depends on the technology. You probably know your computer has something called RAM, which is where documents and programs live just temporarily while you're running them, because RAM tends to be pretty fast, whereas your hard disk is where programs and files live permanently. You can pull the cord, and your files should not actually get deleted, but hard disks use a different technology altogether. But at the end of the day, and here's why we went with binary and not decimal years ago, when you want to implement a computer with a physical device, it's actually really easy to represent the notion of on or off. Consider a light switch. You can go on or you can go off. And actually, how about some gratuitous use of technology? For those of you with an iPhone 4, by far the most useful application for 99 cents is this flashlight in the middle of the night. So this might represent a 1. This now represents a 0. 1, 0. 1, promise it gets more interesting, 0. So why is this germane? Well, if you're implementing a computer that needs to represent information, now all you need is something like electricity, which can be on or off, on or off. And when you actually want to store information on disk, can you actually use, as we'll see in a moment, magnetic particles? But just to hammer home this point, if I could, we have time for one awkward demonstration. And for that, I need a byte of volunteers. All right, first 8 hands that I saw were roughly in here. So come on up, and I'll, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. But you have to be comfortable on stage. That's the catch. Because this is big going out on the internet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Sure, come on up. And the eighth person to stand up, right here. Come on up. Okay, so we now have a byte's worth of volunteers. Why don't we use this side of the stage? And I'll make some room for you. You are the 128s column. You're the 64s, 32s, 16s, 8s. And we're going to have to fix this slightly in a moment. Otherwise, the math is going to get completely screwed up. So if you guys could come over here, but still maintain your alignment. So 128 should be all the way over here. And 1, you should be all the way over here. And you guys similarly need to shuffle. And if you want to come up closer to the stage where everyone can see you. All right, we now have a byte's worth of volunteers. Now, fortunately, this time it's not a speaking role. You just need to express an ASCII character one at a time. And these brave souls are simply going to spell something out for us, just to hammer home this point of binary. Now, each of you is essentially a placeholder or a column. Why don't we have you, when the time comes, raise your hand if you're supposed to be representing a 1. So on, or true is another way we generally put this. And if you are 0, just continue standing there awkwardly. All right. So with that said, we have a 3-letter word. So we'll have 3 rounds of hands going up or down. On the back, they have a little cheat sheet that tells them what to do. So folks, otherwise this gets really awkward and really inaccurate quickly under pressure. So go ahead, round 1. That's OK. So what number first are they representing? 66, right? Because we've got a 1 in the 64s column and a 1 in the 2s column. OK, so now a little cheat sheet up top. They are representing the letter B. All right, so a little pause just to let that sink in. OK, round 2. Execute. It really says on the back of your sheet what you should be doing. All right, what number are they representing now? 79. In fact, if you add up each of these numbers, you should get the decimal number 79 from this binary number here. 79 is, of course, the letter O, so we're almost there. Round 3, go. And this spells? No, it shouldn't spell boy. We have an error somewhere. It's 87, if I did the math right myself. 87, which is? Bow. So take your bow. Thank you very much. All right, that's as soon as we came a little better prepared this time. We brought CS50 stress balls for everyone to make this all the more of an incentive. Oh, that was sweet, wasn't it? But if you can meet with our teaching fellows over there, they're going to ask the legal department to see you next. So, all right, I think we're all set. Thanks. Is that number 8? Okay, oh, you can keep that. You can keep that. Okay, so how does that actually apply to real computers, right? So this is not the most efficient way of representing information. What actually goes on underneath the hood? Well, it turns out, some of you might recall this silly game from years ago, Woolly Willy. Turns out these are really hard to find in the 21st century. So these things called Woolly Willy is just a plastic, this paper man with a plastic cover, and there's all these black magnetic particles here. And if you use this little magnet, you can draw a mustache or hair or eyebrows or whatever on this particular face. Now this is mostly irrelevant to what we're talking about, except for the fact that there are magnetic particles involved and they're really small. Because it turns out what's inside most of your laptops and desktop computers are these things called hard drives. And a hard drive, if you ever open that thing up, is actually just a big metal container that contains one or more platters, so to speak, these circular pieces of metal. And on top of those circular pieces of metal are essentially tiny little magnetic particles like this, so small that you actually can't see them. But if you touch them or open the hard drive and actually poke around, you will do damage because you'll mangle these the alignment of these particles, you'll corrupt your data. But what's interesting is when they're actually there, essentially, if this is a magnetic particle, you can actually represent zeros and ones pretty easily. You don't need a light switch or a light bulb or an iPhone app to turn something on or off. You can take something that's magnetic with a north-south magnetization and just say arbitrarily, this will represent 1, But if it's south-north, this will represent 0. So on a computer's hard drive are, again, a whole bunch of tiny magnetic particles aligned this way or this way. And now that you have patterns of bits after bits after bits, and if you chunk them up into, say, 8-unit quantities, now can you start storing words and sentences and paragraphs and, as we'll see mid-semester, photographs and videos and other more sophisticated file formats. It's one thing to talk about this. Let me go ahead and open up instead a more interesting graphical incarnation of this.
The hard drive is where your PC stores most of its permanent data. To do that, the data travels from RAM along with software signals that tell the hard drive how to store that data. The hard drive circuits translate those signals into voltage fluctuations. These, in turn, control the hard drive's moving parts, some of the few moving parts left in the modern computer. Some of the signals control a motor which spins metal-coated platters. Your data is actually stored on these platters. Other signals move the read-write heads to read or write data on the platters. This machinery is so precise that a human hair couldn't even pass between the heads and spinning platters. Yet, it all works at terrific speeds.
So if you've ever done something bad, like drop your laptop or smack your computer, and you've ever been told not to do this, it's largely because, and if you've never been, don't do this, it's largely because there are these very sensitive moving parts, and there are relatively few moving parts left in today's computers. Some of you, in fact, might not even have these devices anymore with moving parts. The fan is perhaps the only thing left in those of you who have computers with what are called SSDs. But in hard drives, where you actually have these moving platters, here's, in fact, how we get from electricity and magnetism to those zeros and ones.
Let's look at what we just saw in slow motion. When a brief pulse of electricity is sent to the read-write head, it flips on a tiny electromagnet for a fraction of a second. The magnet creates a field, which changes the polarity of a tiny, tiny portion of the metal particles which coat each platter surface. A patterned series of these tiny charged up areas on the disk represents a single bit of data in the binary number system used by computers. Now, if the current is sent one way through the read-write head, the area is polarized in one direction. If the current is sent in the opposite direction, the polarization is reversed. How do you get data off the hard disk? Just reverse the process. So it's the particles on the disk that get the current in the read-write head moving. Put together millions of these magnetized segments and you've got a file. Now, the pieces of a single file may be scattered all over a drive's platters, kind of like the mess of papers on your desk. So a special extra file keeps track of what everything is. Don't you wish you had something like that?
All right, so take it with a grain of salt. It was made by a computer scientist. But now it's fun time. So these things here that you have in your hand is the result of my spontaneously going to Staples before class. I was the only one, believe it or not, at the store who was buying floppies today. What you'll notice very delicately is that there's not all that much to this so-called floppy disk. It's actually a much cheaper example than handing out hard drives. But at the end of the day, if you move this metal thing aside with your fingers, don't squeeze it too hard, you'll see inside that there's a platter, but it's literally a floppy platter. Even though the disks themselves are fairly firm plastic, this thing, if you now go ahead and very gently corrupt a few of the bytes, you can see that you can push down on that thing pretty easily. Now we've ruined them. So why don't we go ahead and take this a step further. Go ahead and just pinch the metal plate. And watch your eyes, because these things do have little springs. Go ahead and just pull that metal plate off. And now you truly can see that there's not much to this disk. And then, this is where you can really tear into this device. If you put your fingers between the plastic opening at the bottom, and here's where you got to watch out for the spring, pull the thing apart. And that's it. The irony is, these things cost like $1 each now because no one needs them anymore. It's kind of a Ecten thing there. But that's it. So unfortunately, we have just ruined roughly 1.4 million bytes worth of data. They came formatted or blank, so not such a big deal. But in fact, if you just run your fingers again and again over this floppy disk, you are disorienting those particles or knocking them off perhaps all together, depending on the medium. And the rest of this thing, this is just a cheap piece of molded plastic. This little felt thing there is just to avoid too much friction from building up with the plastic or to keep it slightly separated from the case. But that's it. That's all there was to those things called floppy disks. But what's amazing is that the hard drives we have today in a desktop or in a laptop, a hard drive in a laptop is only about yay big. It's roughly the same size physically as those floppy disks. And yet how many bytes fit on a typical hard drive today? What's that, 500? So 500 megabytes, this is 1.4 megabytes. So a typical hard drive might have 500 gigabytes, which is 500 billion bytes. And if you have a desktop computer, you might actually have a 1 terabyte drive, a 1.5 terabyte drive, a 2.0 terabyte drive. These are trillions now of bytes. And so it wasn't all that many years ago, frankly, that, you know, certainly people in this class were still using these things. Thankfully, they've fallen into disuse. They're not the most robust things anymore. But the technology and the fundamentals and the ideas, it's pretty much exactly the same as we're using today in some of our modern computers. So any questions on zeros and ones? It's a little awkward asking questions in here, but let's give it a try. Good question. So what happens when you format a floppy disk or format a hard drive? To be honest, not very much. And this is one of the reasons that forensic investigators are actually able to do such a good job for the police and FBI or the like, because so many computer programs, Mac OS and Windows, they'll say, are you sure you want to do this? This will erase everything from your disk. This will erase everything from your hard drive if you so-called format it or partition it, is another piece of jargon you often hear. That generally is just modifying a few bytes, a few kilobytes worth of information, the end result of which is that the computer forgets where all of your files and folders are, but the bits that actually compose those files and folders are in fact exactly where you left them. And so this is why in problem set 5 last year, when I took photographs on campus with a compact flash card, just standard consumer media, and I accidentally formatted that compact flash card, I only lost the first few kilobytes, the first few thousand bits on that compact flash card. But as you probably know, a JPEG, a photograph, these are usually multiple megabytes these days, which means there's a ridiculous amount of data still on that digital camera. And so if you know what patterns of zeros and ones to look for, as you will yourselves this year in that forensics problem set, can you recover a lot of that data? So in short, formatting a disk gets it ready for new data, but it tends not to get rid of the old. And only recently are Apple and Microsoft finally realizing that consumers actually want to securely erase their information for privacy or financial or whatever reasons. But up until now, and even now on some operating systems, it's not, in fact, very easy. Other questions? Yeah.
So the part about where we're talking about, you know, like being in different spaces on the hard drive. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So you might have been taught, especially in years past, to defragment, so to speak, your hard drive once in a while. And this is because as you start writing, saving files to your hard drive, what happens is you might save this file here, then this one, then this one, then this one. But very reasonably, you might go back eventually and delete this one. Now you have a gap in your data, and yet you still have some magnetic particles there that could be useful. So thankfully, modern operating systems allow you to put parts of files here, parts of your file here, parts of your file here, but the end result is that your files get fragmented. The operating system still finds it, but this process of getting some of your files, bits from here, some from here, some from here, induces a potential slowdown. Now, defragmentation, as an aside, is not so much necessary these days because hardware has gotten so performant, but it is, in fact, indicative of what's actually going on underneath the hood. And for a forensic investigator, to be honest, and even problem set 5, it poses a potential wrinkle if those JPEGs, those photos we took, are not contiguous, back to back to back, but are all over the place. That's a lot harder of a problem to solve if you need to reconstruct the fragmentation. Yeah? Good question. So there is this little reading head, kind of like in an old phonograph player, that does move back and forth and in and out depending on the implementation. So there is generally a little computer, a circuit board in the hard drive itself that knows how to tell it to go up, down, left, right, and so forth. And if you've ever heard the word driver, software that you install on your computer so that your computer, your operating system, Windows or Mac OS, knows how to talk to that piece of hardware, it's that driver software that then empowers the operating system to send those commands as well, up, down, left, right, depending on how the disk, the data is laid out on the disk. Let me go over here for another question. What are the advantages of SSDs and how do they work? Let me answer this briefly now and happy to chat more during break time. SSDs are where things are going. SSDs is like using compact flash or SD cards, the things we've had in cameras for several years, but putting gigabytes, soon hopefully terabytes of storage on a device that has no moving parts. Generally, the feature is that they are much faster because they have no moving parts. Even though a hard drive spins at 7,200 times per minute or even faster, that's relatively slower than the speed of light. And so when you actually have a device that's purely electronic, and even that doesn't, the bits don't flow at the speed of light in reality, it's a lot faster of a device. But these days, you pay for it, which is why you get SSDs, you're paying several hundred dollars more. So let's transition from these lower level details, and happy to take questions during break and after, to actually making this hardware do something in software. And for this, I need one volunteer. Let's go in. Okay, right here. Oh, but let's see. Okay, I need a second volunteer for reasons that will be clear in a second. Come on down. Your role has just been changed because you're not wearing any socks today. So come on over here. We're going to have, what's your name?
Sam.
Sam and?
Philip.
Sam and Philip, all right. I'm David, and let's have Philip sit down. You'll play the role sort of a shoe salesman, shall we say?
Okay.
All right, and don't worry, I have a script for you, but not for Philip. So here is a computer program. This is not written in a particular language. This is what's written in what we'll generally call pseudocode. Pseudocode is kind of an English-like syntax that's just a useful way of expressing yourself fairly succinctly, fairly computer-like, but without having to worry about stupid details like whether it's Java or C or whatever. You just kind of say what you mean, but you say it succinctly. But what's interesting about this particular example is, one, it's imperfect. I didn't quite get this program right. Two, it also highlights a number of constructs that we'll see today and we'll see recurring throughout this world of programming, things like loops and conditions and variables and the like. So what we have Philip here for is to actually be the one who, if you could start taking off your shoes and socks, I didn't disclaim this in the beginning, but we very quickly in this course start to hemorrhage volunteers over time. All right. You don't have to touch. It's okay. So this first line of code, I'll get us started, but then I'm going to have you take over and actually instruct Philip what to do here. So this first line of code, and some of this, again, will be rehashed, but at least you can delight in the awkwardness that is this demonstration. So line one, I've numbered the lines just for the sake of discussion. Line one is creating what we'll call a variable. Now, unlike high school math and in algebra, where you call things x and y and z, in programming and computer science, you're actually dealing with humans where it's useful to have a variable name that's more descriptive than X and Y and Z. So here's an example of socks on feet being the number of socks on Philip's feet, which is in fact 0. On line 2, we're going to induce what's called a loop. So do you want to go ahead and Philip, henceforth, you get to stare at the awkwardness. Go ahead and recite for us line 2 of this program.
Okay, while the socks on your feet are not equal to 2,
okay, so while not equal to, so bang equals, exclamation point equals is computer science syntax for saying not equal to. While not equal to 2, which it is not, it is equal to 0, what should he do next?
Open the sock drawer and look for a sock.
Okay.
Nope, one sock.
Excellent. Look for a sock. All right, step 5. Now this is an example of what we'll henceforth call a condition or a branch because it's sort of a fork in the road. Okay, if you find a sock, then put on sock. I intentionally bought the worst socks I could.
No, I like it. You get this.
Available at the Harvard Coop. All right, next line.
socks on feet plus plus.
So this plus plus is sort of shorthand notation for incrementation. So just add 1 to this variable's value. So now socks on feet is, of course, 1. And so next?
Look for matching sock.
Uh-oh. Problem. So where are we at line 9?
If you find a matching sock, which you didn't, so then else.
Okay. So notice again the control flow, and this the choice of indentation here is deliberate. Throughout programming, whether it's in C or PHP or JavaScript in this particular course, the indentation gives you a visual cue as to which lines are related to which others. So the fact that line 9 did not match, if you find a matching sock, which we didn't, that means we immediately jump to the else, which is line 13, and so Philip now has to do what?
Remove first sock from foot.
Oh, man.
And socks on feet minus minus.
We decrement, so to speak, the variable, and then where will we go next in terms of the flow control, the flow of this program?
Back to the while.
Right. So the fact that everything's indented means while the variable is not equal to 2, keep doing this, and so we're going to repeat. Now, rather than go through this again and again, because frankly, you can probably see where this goes before long, we're going to hit some problems. What's one of the problems you see, or that we've tripped over already? If there's no matching socks, then what's going to happen with Philip here? We're going to have a so-called a loop, an infinite loop. And you actually experience this in the real world. If you've ever been using some program, you did something completely innocuous, pull something down from a menu, click a button. You didn't do anything wrong, and yet all of a sudden the thing just starts hanging there, or you get the little spinning beach ball or the hourglass or whatever it is, something completely not your fault. It's not. It's because the programmer or programmers that wrote that software might have been pretty specific, but not specific enough. Computers, smart though they may be and intimidating though they may be, they cannot yet think for themselves. They can't just know what you mean. And so similarly is Gmail's priority inbox going to be pretty flawed for a lot of us, at least initially, because it just doesn't know the answers a priori correctly unless we teach it or program it to be better. There's also another flaw in here, or multiple flaws arguably, but something else catch your eye? This is a very imperfect program. So in fact, we may not find a sock at all, and yet we don't seem to handle that at all, unless if we don't find any socks, what do? We replenish the sock drawer. So if we tease this apart, and this is actually nice. Every semester I get beat up for just how bad this thing actually is. If you start really picking it apart, you find that there's a lot of flaws, but this is intentional, and this is one of the sort of arts that you learn early on, is that with computers, you really do need to be careful, and you need to think about these so-called corner cases, and even you might use popular websites or programs that have so-called bugs or mistakes, and that is simply the result of the programmer not having anticipated some particular problem. So we have a parting gift. Why don't we give Philip both the matching pair and give you each a pair of socks since he didn't yet wear this one. They are brand new. In fact, and a big round of applause for was a little difficult. Take your time. So let's actually now take a 2-minute break. We're going to change tapes and we'll come back and we'll actually write programs with a real computer and some real animated characters. More in just a couple minutes. All right. We are back. So we just wrote a program in pseudocode, or walked through a program in pseudocode. Let's take a quick glimpse at what it's like to write a real program, albeit a very trivial one. Starting next week, you'll actually be using a cluster of systems that CS50 itself runs called cloud.cs50.net. This is a bunch of computers running an operating system called Linux, which has a variety of interfaces to it. More on that next week. But it turns out that on Macs, and if you have the right software on PCs, you can kind of get a teaser of what this environment tends to look like. And before warned, what you're about to see is intentionally very underwhelming. I am going to run a program called nano and type nano hello.c, and I'm going to type the following very quickly without much explanation because we'll dive into this more next week. But what I'm doing here is programming. Sorry, I didn't mean to make it sound so condescending. So this is just a dumb text editor called Nano. Dumb in that it's very simple, which is nice because it eliminates a lot of the complexities of learning a new tool when really all you want to do is solve an actual problem. So I'm going to go ahead and save this file as hello.c. .c hints at the fact that this program I just whipped up is written in a language called C. Now this is underwhelming with what you can do in just a second in this particular language, but again, as per Wednesday's lecture, by end of the semester, you'll be making things like isawyouharvard.com or any websites really that you can imagine can you probably produce after just several weeks of fundamentals like these. So I'm saving this file. Notice there's a few keywords that we'll come back to next week, like main, which is kind of the main part of my program. There's this include, which allows me to include code, source code, so to speak, that other people wrote, so I don't have to figure out for myself how to print things to the screen. Other people are telling me how to, other people have solved that problem for me. And this thing between quotes we'll start calling a string. It's just the sentence or words or whatever that I want to print. And then there's some stupid syntax like curly braces and semicolons that initially are kind of annoying because you have to remember where all this junk goes. But at the end of the day, it's really going to be identical to what we see pictorially with Scratch. I'm now going to run a program called GCC, which is what's called a compiler. Compiler, we'll also revisit next week, takes human text, ASCII text as input, and outputs zeros and ones that represent that program in a manner that the CPU, the Intel inside, actually understands, which is interesting. Damn it, not installed on this computer. So what we would see, I'm going to completely fake this, is a program that operates like that. So I just realized this is a new MacBook Pro that I didn't actually download the compiler onto it, apparently. So good, but that'll give us something to do next week. But what you would have seen is the program just doing this, printing out to the screen. But unfortunately, this is incredibly underwhelming. Certainly in the first week of a course, it's much more interesting if you can actually build things that are interactive, that are animated, that play music and so forth, and not just produce things on day one that output zeros and ones like this. So those are, in fact, the patterns of zeros and ones, the bytes that would have been outputted had I remembered to download the compiler to this computer and ran it on that little hello.c file. But we'll do that again correctly next time. But it turns out that with this language we glimpsed on Wednesday, you can do this stuff so much more easily, and yet the ideas are identical to what we're going to explore at a lower level in the weeks to come. So this is the simplest program you can probably write in this language called Scratch. Scratch is a program that you can download for free, and you will see in problem set 0, which will be posted on cs50.net tonight under problem sets in both standard and hacker editions, it will walk you through the process of getting the software. This software now looks like this. On the top right-hand side is the so-called stage. This is where, as we saw on Wednesday, our sprites or our characters, our little characters are going to play or move as we instruct them to do. On the left-hand side is my palette of puzzle pieces or building blocks, and those are the things in a moment I'm going to drag and drop in order to induce the sprite to do something. And in the middle, this blank slate in the middle, this is where my program's going to go. And so as we saw on Wednesday, if I want to just get this thing started, notice that there is this thing here, when green flag clicked, that's Scratch's version of that keyword main. So main is equivalent to this green flag. What can I now do? Well, it's shaped like a puzzle piece that will allow me to go to the looks palette at top left. And it's pretty self-explanatory. The categories, the colors very quickly start to make sense when you just start poking around. I'm going to drag this thing here, zoom in, and voila, what do I now see? Well, I now have two blocks interlocked, and you can pretty much guess what this is going to do. It's going to say hello, and I can change this here. I can change the number of seconds that it does it, and if I want to detach it, I just click and drag, and now I can go back and put different puzzle pieces there all together. But it turns out that though simple though some of these puzzle pieces actually are, we can actually start to do very interesting things very quickly. So some jargon first. Computers generally have things called, computer languages generally have things called statements. A statement is an action. It's an instruction. It's a capability that just tells the computer what to do, much as you might instruct as a human a robot to do something to the extent that's currently possible. So say, oh hi world, this would be called a statement. Another one might be wait 1 second, which is another building block or puzzle piece in Scratch, and another one might be play sound meow. So now you can start to see that things can get interesting quickly. Well, let's go ahead and do that. Let me go ahead and open up some of the examples that I came with. All of these are available on the course's website, so you can play afterward. And I'm going to go ahead and open a file called hi2.sb, which is the file extension for this language. Now, notice in the middle, I wrote this at home already. You can pretty much read this stuff top to bottom to see what it does. When green flag clicked, I'm going to say, oh, hi world for a second, then wait. Say it again, then wait. Say it again, and then that's it. So let's go ahead and click the green flag. And in fact, very underwhelming. So let's actually start to make this more interesting. Let me go ahead and instead open up what I called hi 3. I'm going to go ahead and say, don't save, because I didn't make any changes. I'll play this. Okay, getting cute. You do that on loop too long, it gets really annoying quickly. But it's just a different statement. And so when you start to poke around the puzzle pieces, you see that it can say things. We'll see movement in just a moment, sound, and so forth. But at the end of the day, this is just like the program we used a moment ago for the sock exercise, where we just told Philip, step after step after step, do this, do this, do that. And yet here, too, we already see an opportunity for that thing we called a loop. I am meowing 3 times. And you can very easily see, perhaps, that this very quickly could get messy. I could do a whole lot of copy-paste, essentially. If I want the cat to meow 6 times, I just make a copy of this, which you can do by right-clicking or control-clicking, as you'll see. And then I just keep doing this and this and this and this. But now, what's the problem? Well, one, it just starts to look ridiculous, frankly. You should acquire over time this instinctive aversion to just code or programs that just look ugly, because things that look ugly generally are not easy to maintain. For instance, if I wanted to change the sound that the cat is making, my God, now I have to change it not 3 places, but like 30 places, if all I've done is copy and paste. So hopefully, there's an opportunity for actually looping and ultimately then doing things conditionally. So if you want to do something conditionally, you generally need to ask a question. Is the following true or false? In Philip's case, we ask the question, does he have 0 or not 0 socks on his feet? Or rather, does he have 2 or not 2 socks on his feet? That's what's called a Boolean expression, named after, literally, a man named Bool. And this puzzle piece here, colored in blue because it's a Boolean expression, is just something that whose answer is either yes or no, true or false, 1 or 0. So notice already the parallels between the lower level details and now these higher level details, so to speak, of actually programming. This Boolean expression allows you to say to Scratch, if you are touching the mouse pointer, the little arrow, do something. How do we do something? We'll see in a moment. What else can you detect as a yes or no answer? Is the mouse down? Yes or no. That can give you a true or false, a 1 or 0 answer. What about this? Is the number on the left less than the number on the right? That might be a question you might want to answer. Or you might want to say, is the thing on the left and the thing on the right both true? Do I have 2 yes answers if you want to check 2 conditions at once? You know, this might seem to be a bit of a new context for some of you, but consider a typical website. If you've been shopping for courses on Harvard Courses, the website we mentioned on Wednesday, well, you'll recall perhaps that there's all these checkboxes, that allow you to say you want a course in the fall or the spring, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Well, now think about, even with today's basics already in mind, that this is just kind of the same idea, where if you want to look for a course that's on the fall and on Monday, Tuesday, that's like saying I want fall and Monday and Tuesday. So each of these checkboxes is itself really a Boolean expression. And so you see this stuff all over the place on Facebook, Google, and the like. These are not foreign concepts. It's just we're now slapping some new, perhaps, jargon on them. Now that you have the ability to ask yes or no questions, you want to be able to branch or fork in the road based on those answers. We saw this with the sock algorithm a moment ago. In Scratch, a condition looks a little something like this. It's a puzzle piece that looks kind of small, but notice there's this little funky shape up top that's the same shape as the blue blocks we just looked at, because you can drag and drop a condition on top of that. And even though there's not much space in the middle here, turns out what's nice about Scratch is it will grow to fill more and more puzzle pieces. If you just drag them and drag them and drag them in there, it will keep growing to fill, to fit any such statements. And you don't just have to have an if or nothing construct. You can say, if this is true, go and do the following pieces of code or puzzle pieces that are inside this part of the block. Else, go ahead and do these. that are down here. And we saw this with Philip's example, but sometimes there's three roads you can take. And so even though it starts to look a little messy if you do this too much, you can certainly branch this way, or this way, or this way. And these are what we generally call conditions. Well, let's actually put these to use. Here's hi4.sb. Kind of a stupid program. Why? Right? So this is a great way of like fulfilling the requirements of a problem set, but not quite the spirit of using a condition. So this is not all that interesting, but let's actually take a look at a fifth version of Hi that actually does something interesting. Oh, it turns out there's a puzzle piece that allows you to pick a random, or as we'll start calling it soon, a pseudo-random number, so that Scratch can effectively roll a dice, or flip a coin, or give you a bit of non-determinism, is the fancy way of saying this. And this is useful because if you're actually writing a program that's interactive, or that you want to change over time, much like you would a game, hopefully the game is not going to have the bad guys, for instance, always standing in the same place, or the rocks or whatever it is falling from the sky in the same place, because this would very quickly become a very tedious game. Almost any game you play has some kind of randomness or pseudo-randomness, which means that things change over time, somewhat unpredictably. So now if I click the green flag, program seems broken, or oh, it's just the number that was picked between 1 and 10 was probably bigger than 5 or 6, not smaller. Let's try it again. Well, let's try it again. There we go. Now, if I do this an infinite number of times, we should get roughly 50-50. But now we have the ability to do things only only once in a while. So now loops. You want to do something again and again. You can kind of see where the syntax is going. Looks like a loop. You can kind of put blocks inside of here, and the little arrow suggests that once you get to the bottom, just like our socks example, you're going to do the following again. What else might it look like? You might be able to say, and we'll see this in C and PHP as well, do the following a bunch of times, but a finite number of times, which might be useful. So here we have a repeat block. Let's actually put this into play with the little sprite known as Scratch. So this is high 6. And now, as promised, and I'll even full screen it to really annoy you. If we weren't so pressed for time, I'd kind of want to see how long we could get away with this before it gets awkward. But that, in fact, is an infinite loop that's hopefully deliberate. Otherwise, it's a pretty bad mistake. But sometimes you do want an infinite loop. For instance, Microsoft Word, if you use it, or Pages or the like on your Mac or PC. These days, those things constantly spell check your program for you. So in a sense, that's a good infinite loop. That is, so long as you're using the program, it's constantly checking your grammar and spelling and underlining things. So if infinite loops aren't necessarily bad if the objective is actually being met. Well, let's take a look at this high 7 variant that also uses loops. That also uses a loop. So this one's a little cute, I like to think. So notice this. My mouse cursor's over here in the top right. Now I touch the cat. Move away. So this is my petting a cat example. Well, how does this work? Well, notice it's just a few puzzle pieces. I'm forever watching the situation, and now if I'm touching mouse pointer, we saw that Boolean expression before, play sound meow, wait a couple seconds, and then just keep checking. So if I left my cursor there, like you're petting the cat, it would just keep meowing and meowing every 2 seconds. But if I move it away, that Boolean expression becomes false or zero, and so we don't do it again. And just to be clear, you can disassemble these programs. You can move this thing over here. It's all about dragging and dropping, which is to say it's very intuitive. You think of the idea, you think of the basic logic, and then you go ahead and drag and drop accordingly. Let's look at this eighth variant of this otherwise simple example. Well, this one was me having a little fun here. So play. So cat meows ad nauseum. But touch the cat and so don't touch this particular cat. So how is this working? Well, again, I'm not spending too much time on these specifics because, again, it should hopefully strike you as, oh, that's kind of intuitive. If something is true, do this. Else, something is true, do that. Well, what are some of the other constructs we're going to have access to, starting with Scratch and C? Well, certainly variables. If you want to maintain state, that is to say remember some value, well, you can use what's called a variable. And here's what it looks like in this language called Scratch. Now, who cares about variables, X's and Y's and all this? Well, what about a game? Anything where you're actually keeping track of something like a score, just having a variable that you increment, plus plus, or decrement, minus minus, using the appropriate puzzle piece could certainly be compelling. Suppose you want a character to move around the screen and collect things. So it doesn't make sense to just use a number because you want this character to collect something from here or there. Well, you can use what's called an array, which is kind of a list or a little satchel of that you might physically carry that you can put things in again and again. And with an array, can you actually keep track of not just numbers, but any kinds of things, other sprites or other pictures or perhaps a little something like this. Let me go ahead and pull up this little example here, lest it look like we're dwelling on only the most simple. Go ahead and click the green flag. You'll see this was written by a former student of ours. Notice the top left is a picture of inventory. That's just a graphical incarnation of this thing called an array. And notice the games can, in fact, interact with the human, much like Wednesday. I'm leaving my house. Oh, here's some cherries. Oh, look. In my array at top left, I now have cherries in it. Let's see what this is, probably an orange. Let me go over here. And now think about how you do this. If right arrow key down, move right. If right arrow key down, move right. If touching sign, display this little cartoon bubble. So let me go get the pineapple. Let me go get the bananas. Let me go get the apple. Where do I have to go? The fruit place? Oh, there's the man at the store. And now we have a loop where he is just looking through my inventory one at a time and reciting what it is I actually picked up. Well, what more can we do with some of these fundamentals? Well, with arrays and the like, after arrays and the like, we have these things called threads. So thankfully, you can do multiple things at once in a program because of what we'll call threads. Here's an example in just a moment of a program, a Scratch project, so to speak, with two sprites, one bird and one cat. And what this means is that even though the interface is getting a little complicated, realize the student did this with baby steps, implemented a little bit of this, a little bit of this, and then over time, it grows to be a pretty impressive program, but it starts off as just a clean slate. Notice at the bottom right here, we have all these different icons. I can click on this guy to see what sprites are controlling him. Here's where this guy yawned. It's because of that script. I can click on the cherries and see what they're doing. You know, not all that much. They're just sitting there, but they are listening for something we'll see in a moment. But let me go ahead and open up, let's say, this cat example, move two. You can even have different sprites interact with each other, much like this. Now, all the cat is doing is it's in an infinite loop, and it's checking, if I am not facing bird, face bird. And it's constant. It's constantly chasing the bird. And so now you have two threads, so to speak, two miniature programs, two sprites all interacting with one another. You can do other things too. And I know I'm flying through these, but only because it's more fun to play hands-on on your own. Oh, actually, this guy's kind of funny. Let's play this. This is all he does. But again, it hints at these fundamentals. You've got a loop. You've got a condition and a Boolean to check if he's touching the edge and some statements that tell him to shout or to actually turn around. So what more is there? There are also these things called events in programming, and specifically Scratch, whereby you can have two sprites, such as this boy and this girl, and when you actually hit the space bar or the like, one sprite can do something, and then the other sprite can do something in response, because in addition to when green flag clicked, there's also this kind of starting point, this alternative to main that says when I receive event. In other words, you can pass sort of secret messages or notes between sprites by giving them a name, like in this case event, and then having one talk to the other. So this is a simple incarnation of that game you might know as Marco Polo. Now, in Problem Set Zero, you get to play with exactly these things. And in the Hacker Edition, if you so choose, can you play with one of these things. I thought I'd demo just a couple little snippets with this. So to be clear, we expect most students to very comfortably pursue the standard edition of the PSET. But for this particular PSET, the Hacker Edition gives you, and we have 150 or so of these out in the hallway, and we'll have them at office hours throughout the coming week, this is a little logic board with lots of sensors, a sound sensor, a light sensor, a little joystick, and the like. And now that you have not just a keyboard, but a device like this connected via USB, can you do something like this, like a former student did? This is a little game. And again, don't be overwhelmed by the complexity. It's all about building up byte after byte. So I'm now moving the joystick, and the goal of this game is not to hit, to get the bananas, but now I've been stunned. Oh, there's the man that fell from the ceiling on Wednesday. And it's responding to the joystick. You can do other things, too, though, when you have sound. For instance, let me go ahead and open up Masquerade. And I'll need Barry's help here, if you don't mind. Let me hit play. So here we have... Come on. Wait, don't do that yet. Come on. I need more lights. Wait a minute. We can solve this. It's a little dark in here as well. Okay, it's very nice and beautiful. Daylight outside. And Barry, could you kill the lights? So can you actually detect sound in this way? Let me stop playing this since it will just go on ad nauseum as well. So what does this actually mean for you? So with problem set 0, which will be posted in two forms, PDF for standard and PDF for hacker on cs50.net tonight, you'll have the choice of implementing pretty much any scratch project you can think of, and with subject to very few constraints. At the end of the day, the goal is to make something that's of interest to you, fun for you, and you'll see at cs50.net/OHS for office hours what the schedule is there for. And let me conclude with this. You have an amazing 10 weeks ahead of you, and so we will see you, if I time this correctly, on Wednesday.